Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Senate fight in Nevada is being called the most important election race in the country. And a number of political pundits are writing and saying today that in the candidates' first and only debate last night, neither Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid nor Tea Party challenger Sharron Angle were brilliant, although they both landed a few blows. Angle accused Reid of wanting to give Social Security benefits to illegal immigrants when their retirement program faces a shortfall and she wants to privatize it.
Man up, Harry Reid. You need to understand that we have a problem with Social Security.
Reid called Angle extreme for wanting to phase out government programs like Social Security.
Social Security is a promise we have to keep. It takes care of seniors in their golden years. That's why I work so hard to protect Social Security. I feel so strongly about this that I took on the President of the United States when he tried to privatize it, and we won that battle.
But John Ralston of the Las Vegas Sun writes today that the veteran Democrat lost the debate because Angle, quote, looked relatively credible, appearing not to be the Wicked Witch of the West and scoring many rhetorical points against Reid. It's the latest page in one of the most turbulent election seasons in years. Gail Chaddick covers politics for the Christian Science Monitor, and she joins us from Monitor Radio Studios in Washington. And Gail, did the debate surprise you? And in your eyes, what does it represent?
It did surprise me, in part because Harry Reid is a very established politician, and he looked very awkward, fumbling for his papers at the end. What is my closing statement? Not being able to answer a yes or no question. But I think it shows you something that is so important about this race. Usually, very established politicians don't face tough races. There are usually, 35 competitive House races out of 435, and, not more than a handful of truly competitive Senate races. Some of these, they're just not used to tough races. And I think he really was not ready for the fact that she didn't, I wouldn't call her the Wicked Witch of the West, but she didn't fall on her face. The expectations were so low that it was actually easy for her to do better than expected, and I think he did worse.
Well, today we're learning, too, that more than 58 million Social Security recipients will not receive an increase in benefits next year, the second year in a row without a cost-of-living increase. And we're also hearing that the federal government is reporting a $1 trillion deficit for the second year in a row. How do you think this news will play out in the voting next month?
I have been really struck talking to Tea Party activists around the country at how oblivious they appear to be to the question you're raising. How will spending that's not going to happen affect me? They're so focused on the size of the debt and the size of taxation that they're not really looking to what government can do that actually is helpful to people and might be helpful to them. They don't come across to me as a particularly well-off group. Under ordinary circumstances, you might think they would be, looking for the government dole, but they're not. And there is a kind of interesting disconnect there that's whether it'll come together before November or afterwards, where there may be buyer's remorse, I don't know. But it's clear that they are thinking on a track that politicians have not had to deal with in a very long time.
Well, you are seeing Tea Party supporters demanding detailed policy pledges from candidates. What kind of things do they want?
I was interested in a race that I think has fascinated the whole country in Virginia's 5th District. Tom Perriello, a freshman, probably the most endangered freshman, won in this fairly conservative district with less than 750 votes and is struggling. He's voted with Democrats on health care, on climate change legislation, on the stimulus, all which are very unpopular.
And he's a Democrat?
He's a Democrat. But in the primary, the Republican who won the primary was up against 6 Tea Party opponents. And one of them, at the end of that race, said he wouldn't endorse him unless he, the Republican, committed to a pledge far more dramatic than anything the Republicans have come up with. It calls for a balanced budget amendment. It calls for cutting a whole any government agency that's not covered in the Constitution. It would audit the Fed, eliminate all earmarks and so forth. And they insisted that he sign this 12-point document publicly. And the other Republican party chairs would only endorse the Republican winner when he signed that 12-point pledge. So I've really been doing some reporting on the extent to which pledges are becoming a factor in this election, and there are lots of them. There's a pledge out there to that 67 Republican incumbents and challengers have signed on to that would zero out health care as the first bill that the House takes up. There are other pledges that would eliminate all earmarks. It's interesting, in your neck of the woods, Scott Brown today voluntarily pledged to seek no earmarks. So I think this notion, not of politicians in Washington offering a contract, but of the general public demanding a pledge, is a sort of sub-theme in this campaign.
Well, thank you very much. Jill Chaddick covers politics for the Christian Science Monitor. The new 2011 model cars are now rolling into showrooms. At least some are. The long-awaited electric Chevy Volt is still unseen, and recent revelations show it may not be as electric as you think. Also unseen for now is Nissan's electric offering, the Leaf. And Ford announced a huge downsizing of its Lincoln brand, as well as a facelift to better compete with other luxury brands like BMW and Lexus. Joining us from Detroit to talk about all that's new in cars is Paul Eisenstein. He's publisher of the automotive news website, thedetroitbureau.com. And Paul, let's start with the Volt. Everybody's talking about it. It's an electric car, but also has a gas tank that will power a backup generator when the battery runs out of juice. Chevrolet announced its official launch this week. So where is it?
Well, right now, where you'll find it most likely is sitting in a little garage out at Metro Airport in Detroit, where a whole bunch of reporters are getting the chance to drive it before it rolls into showrooms. For the public, it'll start showing up in dealers a little more than a month from now.
Have you been behind the wheel?
I've been behind the wheel of an earlier prototype, and I'll have a chance to drive it again in production form in just a matter of days. I will tell you, even when I drove it in that prototype form where they were still tweaking some of the details, it's an impressive ride. The vehicle is very, very transparent. One of the things you don't have are all those shifts that, you know, can be annoying when you're driving a regular car. Even when it goes from electric into that extended range mode, when the gasoline engine kicks in, serving as a generator, you really don't feel it. It's a very smooth, easygoing vehicle. And one of the things that is really nice about the Volt and about the Leaf, which, by the way, I've also driven, and a lot of other electric cars, is something that's going to surprise people when they get into it. Electric propulsion can be extremely fast.
But Chevy seems to have created a bit of a PR mess for themselves, claiming certain things about how the Volt engine would run that apparently aren't true. And as you mentioned, this combustion engine, it sounds technical, but give us the layman's version of what's going on.
Yeah, let me see if I can simplify it as much as I can. From day one, when we first saw the Chevy Volt prototype at the Detroit Auto Show, was that 2008, we have been told that this vehicle, under all circumstances, would be driven only by electric power. That means that the wheels have electric motors that turn them. In some circumstances, when the batteries discharge, there's a gas motor on board, but it only serves as a generator, so that those wheels, again, always are turned by the electric motors. Well, it turns out, in the process of developing the vehicle, they've made some changes. Not unusual. When you're in development, you always make changes. But under certain very specific circumstances, when you're really driving hard on the freeway and slam that throttle down to the floor, they can get a little bit of power directly from the gas engine to the wheels. Very unusual circumstances. Doesn't last very long. For most intents and purposes, it's still an electric vehicle, but there's that little asterisk that they didn't tell us about. And I think, maybe this is a bit of a tempest in a teapot among the media, but the fact is they didn't tell us and they told us something different. So we're, as a collective group, a little bit annoyed. But the good thing is it's a good vehicle to drive, and I think we'll get past that pretty quickly.
Let's talk about the Nissan Leaf electric car. How's it different from the Volt?
Well, here's a fundamental difference in strategy. Volt's idea is we're going to let you have the same basic freedom that you have with a conventional automobile. Yeah, you can drive 40 miles or so on battery power alone, but if you want to go for that longer trip to visit the family over the holidays or visit the vacation home, it doesn't matter. Once the batteries are discharged, you're going to be able to go to a gasoline backup. Leaf is betting that most people really don't need more than about 100 miles range on any particular day, and therefore there will be a significant number of people out there who can live with battery power alone. Now, that's good because you don't have to carry the, as one of the GM people admits, a boat anchor of having that gas engine sitting in the back for those rare occasions when you do need to drive a little bit further. It's a fundamental strategic difference. And what's really cool is it suggests that there's a lot of really creative ideas coming out of the auto industry as they go more and more green.
And it sounds like demand is high. Nissan has had to stop taking reservations for the car. They've already filled up their 20,000 slots for the American market. What's the price tag on these cars?
Well, first of all, yeah, 20,000 is good, but that's still very small. I have to stress that even if all the electric and plug-in vehicles and extended range electrics and regular hybrids next year hit their ambitious sales targets, they'll still account for only about 3% of total U.S. car sales. Now, Leaf, by having just the batteries on board, will come in after a $7,500 federal tax credit at about $25,000. The Volt will come in at about $8,000 more. And the good thing is, if you live in the right state, you may also be able to get as much as a $5,000 credit in places like California on top of the federal tax credit. So there's a lot of money being passed out by quite a few states to really subsidize all this move into electric technology.
Well, another option for the environmentally conscious are the clean diesel cars, which used to not be sold in every state, but now they're available everywhere. And tell us what's new for 2011.
Well, you're going to be seeing the Germans in particular go into a lot more of the diesel technology. They have been the real success story when it comes to diesel. Volkswagen, for example, the brand new Jetta that they're bringing out, they expect that they could sell as much as 20% of those Jettas equipped with diesel powertrains. We're seeing diesels in Mercedes and BMWs and the like. The U.S. makers have been a little reluctant, though GM is now saying it will bring in a passenger car with a diesel. Subaru may, Mazda has committed to bringing in a diesel, and we may see more growth. The big problem with diesel is the cost.
Yeah, it's more expensive than regular gas.
Yeah, both the diesel engine technology, which can be as much as $5,000 more, roughly about what you pay for the additional cost of a hybrid engine, plus gasoline is right now in most of the country cheaper than diesel. And that probably is more damaging to the market than the higher cost for the diesel engine itself. One of the nice things about diesels is they run forever. They're very, very, very bulletproof, which, of course, is why they're so popular with trucks, not just the fact that they're more fuel efficient.
We're talking with Paul Eisenstein, publisher of the automotive news website, thedetroitbureau.com, about what's new on the road in 2011. Just ahead, can you guess what American car is a hot commodity in China? We'll have more with Paul after a quick break. And later in the show, Iran's president goes to Lebanon. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking with Paul Eisenstein, publisher of the automotive news website, thedetroitbureau.com, about new 2011 cars. And Paul, I want to talk a little bit about Ford, because that company announced this month it's going to close 35% of Lincoln dealerships in major metropolitan areas over the next 2 years. And at the same time, it's undertaking a major rebranding of the Lincoln name. So what are we going to see in the showrooms?
You know, we're seeing a bunch of new models. The Lincoln MKT is one of the newest. It's quite a luxurious vehicle. We're seeing an all-new version of their MKX, which is another smaller crossover vehicle. In fact, they're talking about bringing out about 7 new Lincolns over the next 4 years. And rebranding, boy, do they need it. This is an old car. Even with the market among limousines and livery services and hearses, it just had to go away. Unfortunately, a brand that once was associated with a pinnacle of luxury, at least North American luxury, is now seen as the old man or woman's car, something that's really out of touch. People in California, New York, other key markets don't even think about Lincoln. And that's going to be the big challenge. They have to come up with something that is absolutely distinct and exciting.
Then there's Toyota. We can't talk about cars this year without talking about what happened with Toyota. 9 million safety recalls over the last year, the most dangerous being this sudden acceleration problem drivers were experiencing. You're right, Toyota is adding a brake override system to all 2011 models, as well as a kind of a black box, like they use in airplanes, is it, to monitor events that have to do with an accident?
The good news is they are not going to be recording your conversations, but they will be
That's a relief.
That is a relief, isn't it? But they will be recording what you're doing. So if you're really speeding, that may wind up in court. That's one of the controversies about putting black boxes into automobiles. But you'll see them in virtually every car going forward. It'll just make it easier to investigate exactly what's happening in an accident and ultimately to help make cars safer. These brake overrides will make it almost impossible for a person who's trying to stop the car by stepping on the brake not being able to bring the car under control. If the engine is racing out of control, it will electronically essentially disconnect the engine.
These are safety features. Is there anything worth noting model-wise for Toyota in 2011?
Well, they're going to be bringing out more than a half dozen new models during the calendar year. They're launching with several new ones right away. They're coming out with a new version of their Highlander. Of course, we also saw the big Avalon went through a recent update as a 2011 model. And we're going to see some new products from their Scion division. For example, we are going to see a new version of the TC. We're going to be seeing the IQ, which will be the smallest four-door in the world. I mean, this thing is not much bigger than the little smart car, but will fit four people inside.
And I understood you talked with one of Toyota's top executives. What did he say about the upcoming year?
Well, it's going to be a very important one, obviously, because they really have to recover from the mess that they made for themselves. Don Esmond, who is their top sales and marketing exec, told me that they are about to bring out a second Prius. And so you'll be seeing more cars with the Prius name, but that won't be just the Prius, won't be the simple sedan that we've come to know.
Will that be in 2011?
We're not sure exactly when. It'll probably come out as a 2012, but it'll be sometime, I think, in the calendar year 2011. He's not saying. He's keeping that darn thing a secret. But I can tell you that it will probably be a more stylish and more versatile vehicle than the Prius model that we see today.
Well, despite all the talk about hybrids and electric cars, as you say, the internal combustion engine is still king. It dominates the market with 97% share of it. So with that in mind, what else is out there for the average driver who just wants a normal, comfortable, affordable car to get around in?
Oh, boy. Do you know that there are over 250 different cars on the road right now, different models, and that doesn't include variations like DXs and LXs and so on? It is the most crowded the automotive market has ever been. So whether you're looking for a small car of the Toyota IQ size or Scion IQ, all the way up to the redone version of the Ford F-Series pickups, you're going to be seeing a lot of new product for the model year. One of the hot cars that I think people are going to be taken by surprise with is the new Kia Optima, not a particularly well-known name. But this is an extraordinarily stylish, fun vehicle. It's very closely related to the Hyundai Sonata. In fact, those are sibling brands. But it is probably going to be the most stylish midsize model on the market, and it's going to make a lot of waves.
And I understand that some other brands might be making waves. What are they?
Well, Hyundai, the sibling brand, that is a name that virtually disappeared from the American market not that many years ago. 5 years ago, 6 years ago, Hyundai was in deep, deep trouble. When you said the name, people thought tinny, cheap, low quality. They came back with this 10-year warranty and good products, good prices, and now the Hyundai Sonata, for example, is selling so well they can barely keep up with demand. Then there's Buick. I actually drove here in a Buick Regal that I'm test driving, and this is a brand name that virtually disappeared. In fact, it probably would have been dropped by General Motors during the bankruptcy last year when they eliminated half the North American brands, but for one thing, China. The Buick brand is the top brand in China, and they decided to give it one more chance here. Well, the fact is they're scoring big with products like the LaCrosse and now the new Regal.
And tell me about their prices. What do they cost? Are they competitive?
It depends on the model. The Buick Regal is in the 20s.
And what about the Kia and the Hyundai?
Same thing. You can get into a Sonata and a Kia Optima in the high teens and into the 20s. This is a year when the buyer is king. The fact is that the new car market is down more than 40% from where it was at its peak mid-decade. And manufacturers right now don't have much room to increase prices, even though they're loading vehicles up with all sorts of new features. A lot of safety features are becoming standard, like six airbags, electronic stability control, and the like. But at the same time, we're seeing more incentives because manufacturers have to compete, and that includes a lot of givebacks.
Paul, thank you so much for talking with us about cars.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
Paul Eisenstein is the publisher of the automotive news website, thedetroitbureau.com. He spoke to us from the studios of Radio Broadcast Services in Detroit. Monday on Here and Now, a closer look at healthcare costs. We'll hear how one man negotiated a $37,000 hospital bill down to $1,500. That's Monday. News is next, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England, and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com. And the Institute of Contemporary Art on the Boston waterfront. Discover the power and beauty of new art and ideas, icaboston.org.
I'm Monica Brady-Myrov, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama comes to Boston tomorrow to campaign for Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick. Patrick is facing three challengers in the November election: Republican Charlie Baker, Independent Tim Cahill, who left the Democratic Party to run against Patrick. He's also the state's treasurer. And the third challenger is the Green Rainbow Party candidate Jill Stein. The Massachusetts gubernatorial race has been marked by nasty allegations of political dirty tricks. Cahill, the independent, has filed a lawsuit against a former aide, accusing the aide of colluding with the Republican candidate, Charlie Baker. There's also a congressional race here in Massachusetts that's attracting national attention. Veteran congressman and chairman of the powerful House Financial Services Committee, Barney Frank, is facing a political newcomer, Republican Sean Bilott, a Marine reservist. Here and Now's Fred Tice reports on the latest debate between the candidates last night on public television here in Boston.
One of the sharpest exchanges between Barney Frank and Sean Bilott began with a question to Bilott from host Emily Rooney about when people should be able to collect Social Security.
I think that we need to allow individuals to allot a portion of their Social Security payment to an individual account. So that
it's
they
a partial have, privatization.
Correct. So that they have access to that when they retire. I think you can
At
offset
what age?
That. I don't know. The idea of saying I can sit here today and tell you that it's 68 or 72 or...
Frank didn't miss a beat.
He just suggested 72. I think we ought to rule out...
He did suggest 72.
Mr. Bilott, it's a
hypothetical.
You just said you didn't... I'm sorry that you don't like what you say.
You said
70, please don't
maybe.
Blame me for repeating it. No, you said it could be 68. I don't know if it's 68. I don't know if it's 72. I think it's a great mistake to even suggest that you might get to 72 in Social Security. I believe that instead we ought to be talking about...
And you, this is demagoguery. But go ahead.
Well, it's demagoguery when I quote what you said. You said that it might be 72. I think that that's a great mistake. I think, frankly, part of the problem is that you're not familiar with the district we both want to represent. You go to Fall River, New Bedford, Taunton. You go to people who've been working physically hard all their lives, whether they're men or women, and tell them that, no, you can't.
I know more about hard labor than you do, but go ahead.
I understand that you don't like it when I try to make points that you're sort of embarrassed by, but I'm going to continue.
Both men are so good at arguing with each other, it's as if a team of writers was scripting these debates. By this point, Frank and Bilott are like an old couple when they get together. They seem to relish needling each other. They appear comfortable with the idea that they're running against each other, even though Bilott's race against Frank has only taken off in the last few weeks. They get testy, but they never stop being good-natured, and they keep the debate to the issues. Most of the time, after a debate, the candidates go off to their corners and take questions from reporters separately. In this case, like a good, passionate discussion, their debate spilled out into the halls of WGBH. Frank was talking about how Bilott likes the ideas of Congressman Paul Ryan, a Republican from Wisconsin who wants to reform Social Security and Medicare.
That he supports Paul Ryan and wishes that Paul Ryan's ideas were in the Republican pledge, and that's why he hadn't supported the Republican pledge. Mr. Bilott will object, and I sent it, but I'll send you the copy of his statement as to why he couldn't be for the Republican pledge, because it didn't include Paul Ryan's ideas on the title.
He can send it if he can find it or write it himself, because it didn't happen.
But you have said that you support Paul Ryan's ideas.
I did say because it didn't have entitlement reform. I absolutely said that.
For Bilott, this campaign against Barney Frank, in which he says he's gathering large numbers of small contributions from around the country, is still very new. How new revealed itself a few moments later last night. Bilott was still talking to reporters about Social Security.
It's about getting down and figuring out what good approaches are. And right now, Barney Frank and too many people in Congress positions are.
Bilott noticed that a photographer working for Frank was taking pictures.
You know, we can send you some.
Get used to it, dude. If you want to be a congressman,
you're with Barney, right?
So?
That's cool.
Several minutes later, Bilott and Frank were still talking on the street this time about how appropriate the behavior of Frank's photographer was. The governor's race has deteriorated into accusations about who stabbed whom in the back first. The debate in the 10th congressional district has gotten nasty and personal. But in the 4th district, it is still witty and high-minded and lots of fun.
That report from Here and Now's Fred Tice. And Fred mentioned the 10th congressional district race here in Massachusetts. 5 candidates are in a heated battle to replace Democrat William Delahunt, who's retiring. Just ahead, baseball in October, Here and Now. While the world's attention was focused on the mine rescue in Chile this week, the president of Iran has been in Lebanon, taunting Israel and getting a hero's welcome. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's visit has become a show of strength for Hezbollah, the militant Shiite group that fought a brutal 34-day war against Israel in 2006. Iran's ties to Hezbollah date back nearly 30 years and funnels millions of dollars to the group every year. The American and Israeli governments have criticized the visit as an unnecessary provocation, but Ahmadinejad has been warmly received. The BBC's Wira Davies prepared this report.
This is Hezbollah's homeland. Thousands of Shia Muslims, men and women in their separate sections, chanted pro-Iranian and anti-Israeli slogans, extolling the virtues of Hezbollah fighters in past conflicts with Israel. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is arguably more popular here than he is at home in Iran.
I love Iran. Iran helps Lebanon very much.
I came here today to see Mahmoud Ahmadinejad because he's a good person and he gave us electricity and water and all of this.
I'm Jordanian and I'm Palestinian, and I came here to support that man because he's defending justice in the world. As a Palestinian refugee, I do feel that we have another president.
Ahmadinejad is a good president. He gives Hezbollah money to buy weapons to defend our country from Israel. Ahmadinejad makes all of us feel strong.
Mr. Ahmadinejad says this visit is all about trade and building strong links with a country which he says he has no interest in dividing. But this was a clear show of strength by Hezbollah, which is intent on expanding its power base. I asked Farhat Bilal, a Hezbollah MP, about allegations that the Shia movement was busy rearming itself for another war with Israel.
Rumors are rumors, and our policy is always the same. We do never answer yes or no. We have our place. We are defending our country. We never been intruders to other countries. We have all the authorization of whatever we want to do, we will do. We have all the possibilities to try to get and to protect ourselves and to protect our country. So whatever they say, we cannot say yes, we cannot say no.
Behind the symbols and controversy, this was an important state visit. I asked the political analyst Jean-Pierre Catribe what it really meant for this troubled country.
The particularity of this visit carries a significant weight for Lebanon at large. Hezbollah is ideologically and strategically and financially and militarily beholden to the state of Iran. So his visit may be seen as supporting all the more Hezbollah against the moderate Lebanese who are fed up with war, who are fed up, you know, with resistance, and mostly who are fed up with using their country as a launchpad for setting regional scores.
And many Lebanese sick and tired of foreigners trying to intervene in Lebanese politics and treating Lebanon as a client state?
What's happening here is that all communities are competing for a very tight center in terms of prerogatives and powers. Most of these are soliciting regional and international intervention to expand their influence in the central authority, unfortunately, often at the expense of state sovereignty and other Lebanese. So foreign intervention cannot be just eradicated from Lebanon. I mean, this is not a magic word
because
of sorts.
Because it's encouraged from within, isn't it?
Because it's encouraged from within, absolutely, absolutely.
That report from the BBC's Weera Davies in Lebanon. It's down to the final four. No, it's not March Madness, but Major League Baseball's League Championship Series, which gets underway tonight. Joining us for a preview is Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Good to see you, Bill.
Oh, it's good to be back.
So tonight, the New York Yankees and the Texas Rangers begin a best-of-seven playoff for the American League pennant, and the Yankees have dominated Texas in postseason play. But does Texas have a reason for hope?
Not unless they can pitch Cliff Lee every night. He's indestructible, but not quite that indestructible. He's been magnificent in the postseason, no matter which uniform he's been wearing. He was great for the Phillies last year against the Yankees. Unfortunately for Texas, he won't make an appearance until Game 3, and I think you have to give the Yankees the edge.
And the Yankees will send C.C. Sabathia to the mound in Game 1. But beyond him, how does the rest of New York's pitching rotation shape up, especially if this series goes 7 games?
Compared to the pitching rotations in the teams that they would have to face in the World Series, not very good. Sabathia's great worry right now is that he's gone too long between starts. There's a little bit of worry that he'll be too strong, which is a strange thing, might seem a strange thing for people who don't follow baseball. But, you know, pitchers like to get into a routine, go every 4 days, 5 days, whatever it might be, and he's had a little more rest than that.
And in the National League, Philadelphia hosts San Francisco tomorrow night with a starting rotation of Roy Halladay, Cole Hamels, and Roy Oswalt.
Doesn't that sound like three guys who should be at the OK Corral
or
fighting
band,
it out either for or against Wyatt Earp?
Yes.
Cole Hamels. I mean, that's a name right out of the American West, isn't it?
Shoot him up. Well, Philly seems to have the statistical advantage with this lineup, but the Giants have had pretty good success against them.
Yeah, they have, and the Giants, of course, have the sentimental favorite tag because they haven't won the World Series since 1954 when Willie Mays was in his prime. The Phils have revenge on their minds. They'd like to get back to the World Series. They'd like to play the Yankees in the World Series, and they'd like to beat them this time around. So there's all kinds of interesting subplots in play, as is usually the case in autumn baseball.
Well, no matter who makes it to the World Series, it seems Major League Baseball is waking up and scheduling these games a little earlier so that people, especially kids, can stay up and watch them.
I hope that's the reason they've scheduled a couple of these games a little earlier than usual. I'll be very disappointed if I find out that there is some secret Byzantine financial benefit that they're realizing. But I love the idea that they've actually heard the complaints about the game starting so late that kids couldn't watch them end.
And one final note, the Boston Red Sox, they are not in postseason play, but they're in the news. The Associated Press is reporting that the team's owners have completed a deal to buy the Liverpool soccer team. What are your thoughts?
My thoughts are, if it is true that the deal is complete, that's quite wonderful, because the last I heard, it was being tied up in courts on two continents, in Texas and in the UK. It's not really the Red Sox who are buying Liverpool. It's John Henry Enterprises, which is expanding to include businesses all over the world, race cars, soccer, etc. One hopes that he'll remember that he still owns the Red Sox.
Bill Littlefield is host of NPR's Only a Game. Bill, thanks as always.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Before we go today, children's author and illustrator Jan Brett takes a bus tour to meet her young readers, and we tag along. You're listening to Here and Now. ¶¶
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. Children's book author and illustrator Jan Brett is known for reimagining classic tales like Goldilocks and the Three Bears and the Gingerbread Man, making them into vivid new stories with exotic creatures in faraway settings. She also adds hidden storylines unfolding on the borders of the pages. She sold more than 34 million books and is perhaps most famous for her 1989 story, The Mitten, that retells a Ukrainian folktale. Now Jan Brett is out with a new book, The Three Little Dassies. She's bringing it to readers on a cross-country book tour, traveling in the kind of bus usually reserved for rock bands. She's with her husband and road manager, Joe Hearn, a bassist for the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Here and Now's Kevin Sullivan caught up with the bus as Jan and Joe wheeled out of Boston.
Hello.
Come right on in.
All right, thank you. Hello.
Hi.
This is great. Hi, I'm Kevin.
Nice to meet you, Jan.
Be
very careful.
Oh, my goodness. So you do this every year? You just get in a bus and start going on a book tour?
I've done it twice. And it's great fun because I'm able to go to a lot of smaller towns that I wouldn't go if I had to go take a plane, go through security. Because if I don't show up at a book signing, they don't say, oh, her plane was late. They say, Jan Brett didn't come and sign my book because you're like six.
So what's it like driving around on this bus on your book tours? And I guess you must just be flocked with kids when you stop. What happens?
I have a presentation for them because it's more than just buying the book. I like to be able to show them how, give them an art lesson. We try to make it kind of an event so that it's a celebration of reading.
Let's go to your new book, The Three Little Dassies. Is that how you say it?
Little Dassies, yep. It's an Afrikaans word for rabbit. But they're nowhere anything like a rabbit. Has no other relatives except for elephant, aardvark. And they look a little bit like a cross between a koala and a woodchuck, I think. And they live in family groups. And we were at a camp one time in Namibia, and they were scurrying around and sunbathing and just being little anthropomorphized animals because of their, you know, you could definitely see the mother or the father. And then we saw the shadow of this big eagle swooping over the rocks, and then all of a sudden, whoop, they all disappeared into their little rock houses. And so on the way home in the plane, I said to Joe, I love those little dassies because everybody goes to Africa. The zebras, the giraffes, the lions, the cheetahs. And I love them, but I also like the smaller animals. They're so interesting. And then when we were there, we also met these people, the Hororo people, that wear these beautiful traditional dresses all the time, not just on festivals or special days. And they're made out of this fabric, this cotton calico fabric, and everyone is more beautiful than the next in beautiful colors. And then their wealth is in their cattle, like many African groups. And they have a turban that is shaped with horns going to either side.
So when you went to Namibia, were you taking a lot of photos? How did you recreate this when you started writing the book?
I do take pictures. I bring back a lot of stuff, like these beads that I have on our ostrich egg beads that the San Khoi people made. And, oh, those are my dolls that I brought back that I got at the airport. They're all made from the beautiful fabrics that I was describing. So I bring back stuff, but I'm mostly looking. And actually, this place is a World Heritage Site because it has these petroglyphs of ancient carvings. They're probably 12,000 years old. Beautiful, chipped into the rocks. And it's so similar to what I do. There's some human need to draw and depict and make a world. And it has a freshwater spring there. And that's actually where we were when we saw the dassies and the eagle and the agama man, which is a special lizard, agama lizard. He's blue with a red head. And then his arms and legs look like a bodybuilder. So he looks like a little person peeking up over the rocks. So all these characters just came and they hijacked me and made me tell the story.
I was reading this book to my son last night. He didn't even flinch when I said Agama Man or Dassies even, whereas I'm scrambling to get to the last page or the book flap to try to figure out what the heck are these things.
Is that because you're a grown-up, do you think? Kids are the best audience because they're so vibrant and intelligent. It's just bubbling over. And what they haven't learned is a sophisticated language. So that they look to the pictures, and it's like it's a little conduit to them. They feel that they can just walk into the pages. They get out their pointer fingers. If I see the children looking with their pointer fingers out, kind of like following along across the page, then I know I've done my job.
I was wondering if you saw the New York Times piece this week that talked about how books like yours, basically, although they did say that you're not in any danger of falling off the bestseller list, but books like yours, big picture books for young kids, are kind of falling out of vogue, somewhat pushed by parents who think, you know, their kids have to get into Harvard and they have to start reading chapter mm-hmm. books when they're, you know, 4 or 5 mm-hmm. years old.
Yeah. I bet if you asked all the teachers what they thought about that story, they'd say, well, look, they've got to learn to read. And the best way to teach a child to read is to give them a wonderful book where they're going to be engrossed in the story and be able to look at the pictures. And the other thing that's good about the pictures is if you're struggling learning to read, you can just look and see what the expression of the character is, and you kind of are compelled to try to find out more about them if you've done a good job. This first page that I'm showing you has got one of the typical farms that you see. And in the olden days, they would have these baboons that would be the goat herds. Baboons! They would be the goat herds, and they would ride the goats, and they'd go off with them, and if they see a bad snake, then the baboon would scream. But they don't have them very much anymore.
Yeah, I don't see any in this picture.
No baboons. No, I had to stick. There were so many creatures that I decided that I better just stick to the story. You know, people say, oh, you know, how do you get ideas for the borders? It's like, no, my problem is sticking to the story and not just going off on tangents everywhere and having, you know, so many stories you can't see the forest through the trees.
This is really your signature style, where you tell a part of the story that's not contained in the main frame in the borders of the books.
You know, it's really just a reflection of how my mind works. It's a tapestry rather than a big piece of architecture. The Mitten was really the first book, it's 20 years old, that people kind of recognized my style with the borders, that you could follow along. Things are happening off stage, as so to speak.
So sometimes the things happening in the borders are sort of reflected a little bit uh-huh. in the text, but then you get to when the Dassies are captured by the eagle.
Oh, yeah.
And then we see a Gamma man making his way up the cliff, but you don't mention that in the text.
No.
So
I like to keep a lot of things, not secret, but for an observing person, you can see that. And I love that idea, because when I was little, I used to love to search for clues. And the best thing that ever happened to me in a book signing, well, one of the best, was this little boy had a book, and it had a jack-in-the-pulpit plant. It's a wildflower. It grows about 3 feet tall, which is about the size of a little kid that's maybe 7 or 8. And I have a mouse in it because it's kind of funnel-shaped. And so he said, we have this in our backyard. He pointed to the picture. It was in Goldilocks and the Three Bears. And his mother goes, no, we don't, thinking it was like a planted garden. And he said, no, we do. And I said, well, is your backyard kind of marshy because that's where they grow? And she said, yeah, it is. And I said, probably a wildflower. And then he gets this little twinkle in his eye, and he goes, but we don't have a mouse in ours. He just totally understood that I was being whimsical with it. And you got the feeling that he was going to go home and draw something that had that kind of like secret life. Or not secret, but, you know, an inner life, let's say, more complex.
That's children's author Jan Brett speaking to Here and Now's Kevin Sullivan about her new book, The Three Little Dassies. If you're curious about what a Dassie looks like, go to our website, hereandnow.org, where you'll find a slideshow of Jan's work. You'll also be able to see a video tour of Jan's bus and hear about Jan's new project featuring a turtle who paddles around with a garden on her back. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov. Robin Young will be back on Monday. Please join us again, Here and Now.